Blog Talk Radio.
You are listening to ATP Radio with Barry Nussbaum.
Welcome to ATP Radio. I'm your host, Barry Nussbaum. Before we get into it with our incredibly special honored guest today, I want to remind listeners to take out your cell phones if you already have not subscribed to our free alert system. At ATP, we send out all of our shows and content absolutely free. All you have to do is text the word TRUTH, T-R-U-T-H, and send it to 88202. Push send. You'll be automatically subscribed to our free text message alert system. You'll get all of our content like today and all the other shows absolutely free on your cell phone, but it only works within the United States. So for those of you listening in Europe, Israel, the Middle East, etc., sorry, it's not worldwide yet. For those people, go to our website, americantruthproject.org, and you can sign up for free there. So, that being said, I am thrilled to introduce our very special guest today, all the way live from Israel. We are being joined by Danny Aiello. For those of you that aren't familiar with him and his relationship with American Truth Project, Danny has served Israel overseas as part of the ambassadorial staff at the United Nations, and the country of Panama, was the United States representative from the State of Israel as the Israeli ambassador to the United States. He's been deputy foreign minister. He's close with the prime minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, and he is a good friend of the Nussbaum family. So welcome, Ambassador Danny Aiello.
Well, Barry, thank you so much. It's a real honor and pleasure to be back with you, and I really look forward to meet up again, Corona permitted. I hope it will be soon. I also want to second everything that you have called, and I hope everyone that can will join your ATP network. I think not only it is insightful, it is also speaking the truth, promoting really freedom and the values that we all share in the Judeo-Christian world, in the Western world. And we need, Barry, more people like you. We need more ATPs that you were so generously established and financed.
Well, that's very kind. I appreciate your nice words. And let's jump into it. As you know, unlike Israel, which never has an election, we are going through our own craziness right now, as we say in Yiddish. Mishigas is here as well. And we're just a few weeks away from deciding who the next president of the United States will be. We know Donald Trump's policies because we've seen them for nearly 4 years. Let's talk about former Vice President Joe Biden, who we'll talk about in a minute, your relationship with him personally. He said recently that if he's elected president, he will reopen the Palestine Liberation Organization's diplomatic mission in Washington, D.C. Trump closed it. And he will restore funding to the Palestinian Authority. He said that he'll open the U.S. consulate in East Jerusalem, which will serve the Palestinians. And here is his quote. A priority now for the cause of Israel-Palestinian peace should be resuming our dialogue with the Palestinians and pressing Israel not to take actions that make a two-state solution impossible. He went on to say, quote, I will reopen the U.S. consulate in East Jerusalem. I will find a way to reopen the PLO's diplomatic mission in Washington. and I will resume the decades-long economic and security assistance efforts to the Palestinians that the Trump administration stopped. So as everybody knows, Trump cut off virtually all U.S. assistance to the Palestinian Authority due to their pay-for-slay program, where they literally pay terrorists to kill Israelis, to bomb, murder, stab, sabotage, etc. What do you think, Ambassador, of Joe Biden's plans for Israel and the Palestinians?
I think that would be a major mistake. I think that would be a grave setback for the entire peace potential, and certainly for stability and security in the Middle East and much beyond. I'm afraid this will undo all these achievements, and they were major ones, and we can, of course, describe why they were so important, but it will undo the entire new architecture of the Middle East that was achieved in the last 4 years. And that will take us back, not just 4 years, it will take us back 100 years back with all the terror and the violence and the bloodshed. And this will further peace away, because if there is any chance for peace, is only through direct negotiations between us and the Palestinians, without preconditions, without vilifying the other side, as the Palestinians do, without calling on the entire international community to put pressure on Israel so they will not need to step up to the table and make any compromises. This will again put Israel back in a corner, which means we will not compromise. You know, we will have just to defend ourselves. And that would hurt very much, not just Israeli interests, American interests, because it will put Iran and Hamas and Hezbollah back on, I would say, on a leadership position. And it would put all of America's allies here, Israel, Gulf countries, Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, it would put them under immense pressure. That would bring back Russia to a much more influential role, and that is going to really hurt, first strategically, and also from a military point of view, economically, and the leadership. I think also that would put back the United States into a position of a, may I dare say, paper tiger, and that does not command any respect from foes or friends alike, and that could be detrimental not just to the United States leadership, but to the United States interests.
Well, for those people that don't know, obviously you and I know quite well, what does pay for slay mean?
Okay, for that, you need to go to the codex, to the books, to the legislation records of what is called the PA, Palestinian Authority. They have a legislative body, which is called the Palestinian Parliament, and they are the ones, you know, since the Oslo Agreement, they have more than an autonomy. This is what people do not understand, even, that they control their own lives. 40% of the West Bank is Palestinian. 100% of Gaza is Palestinian, but this is another issue that we can discuss later. But in any case, since 1994, where the Palestinians have full control of 40% of the West Bank. They have the Palestinian Authority, which is like a government, and they are the ones who finance the terrorism, and they are the ones who are very intransigent in not wanting to negotiate with Israel in good faith. They are the ones who are committing all this, what called, and rightly so, the political war against Israel, BDS, calling for sanctions against Israel all around the world, and especially in the United States, in order to render Israel a pariah country, so it will be isolated and then would be weakened, and then the Palestinians can do whatever they want without giving an inch. Now, their legislative body, the Palestinian parliament, have probably about 10 years ago, give or take, legislated where that every Palestinian who kills Israelis is to be rewarded. And if that Palestinian terrorist is being killed during his terror act, his family is to be rewarded for life. Now, this is not even the half of it, because there is also a tariff. And all you have to do is just read the law, which says that the more Israelis you murder, the more money you get. Now, if this is not an incentive and a call for murder and a call for, I would almost want to say, genocide, because they target Jews. They do not allow Jews to live in their areas. They are performing ethnic cleansing, as they did in Bethlehem, to all the Christians of Bethlehem. You know that until 1994, when Israel gave Bethlehem to the Palestinians, 70% of all Bethlehem residents were Christians. Today, they're only 9%. So this pay to slay is something which is a not just a war crime. It's a crime against humanity. And this is why I cannot fathom American refinancing the Palestinian Authority, because a big chunk of this money is being given to terrorists in order to encourage them to murder more.
So this isn't a secret, Danny. In other words, you haven't done some sort of undercover secret agent work to discern this. It's out in the open. In fact,
absolutely.
On a number of occasions, President Trump, in the early years of his administration, had Mahmoud Abbas face-to-face and told him, cut it out, or we're going to cut you off. And from what I understand, Abbas said to Trump's face, it will end, it's over, went back to Ramallah, where his seat of government is on the West Bank, and promptly disregarded everything he said and said it would remain part of the Palestinian Authority's policies, correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So how does the rest of the world, and more importantly for us here in America, tolerate a former U.S. senator, a former vice president of the United States, and quite possibly the next president of the United States, having the audacity to say, I'm going to start giving them money again, and I know they spend a considerable portion of their budget encouraging and rewarding murderers, but, you know, I'm going to give them money anyway to kill Jews.
Well, the facts are known. They're indisputable. Problem is that half of the world turns a blind eye. They just look away. It's starting with the Europeans. Of course, I'm not talking about Muslim countries, but the Europeans and others, and many, I would say, political circles also in the United States. And I can only surmise that it cannot be ignorance. It cannot be naivete, because it's well known. So would it be weakness? Would it be just a matter of hypocrisy? Because all those who this pay to slay of the Palestinians, they accuse Israel of committing war crimes, which is so far from the truth. And those who would support pay to slay, basically at the end of the day, would also support terror acts against American GIs, whether it's in Iraq or in Afghanistan or anywhere else. You see, Barry, there is a divide today, pretty much in the international community. Those Western countries that believe and cherish life and hope for the future, building for their children and grandchildren, and there are those who want to sow chaos, who want to take over. In case of the radical Islam, they want to Islamicize the world and live by their own Sharia laws. They understand at this point that militarily they're not strong enough to take us over, not the United States and not Israel. So what do? They try to weaken us through international organizations, whether it's the UN, whether it is the UNESCO, you know, the UN Culture and Science Organization, which decrees that the Temple Mount is Muslim. And most of Christian countries in Europe voted for that against their own heritage, their own. It's just pity, I would say.
Self-denigrating. Okay, it sounds to me, you know, I've been on the Temple Mount. I'm sure you have as well. It is the most holy place for Jews. It is a holy place for Christians, because when the temple was there and the Ark of the Covenant was there, you know, in early Christian days, it's where Jesus was and went. Long before Islam ever existed. Mm-hmm. And yet, for the life of me, I've always been upset about this. In 1967, when Israel liberated East Jerusalem and the temple and the old city from Jordanian illegal control, they gave up control of the Temple Mount to the Jordanian Waqf, which is the religious body that makes up rules that, to me, as an American, seems ridiculous and prejudiced against Jews and Christians. Do you disagree?
Not at all. That was a major, major mistake. At that time, Moshe Dayan, which was the Minister of Defense, he said he didn't want to create another Vatican in Jerusalem. That means having Christians pilgrimage and Jewish pilgrimage in Jerusalem, like the Catholics go to Rome. He also said that by putting Israel's flag on the Temple Mount, it will rile up the entire Islamic world, which was not at all the case. You know, we were always being warned if we move the American embassy to Jerusalem, the entire Islamic world is going to explode. Nothing of the kind. If the U.S. will recognize the Israel's annexation of the Golan Heights, the entire Arab world will explode. None at all. This was.
Let's talk about that. You know, that's an interesting point, and it's a perfect segue into my next comment. Saudi Arabia is landmass the biggest, and influence in the Sunni Muslim world the most influential by far. And I put this in air quotes, an ally, unquote, of the United States. And quite frankly, when Saudi Arabia says something in the Arab world, it is followed. If not verbatim, at least it sets policy. As I've reported on for years, there have been back channel cooperation going on between Saudi Arabia and Israel, especially sharing intelligence, understanding of the threat of radical Islam coming out of Iran, the spread of their Shiite-sponsored terror. And in the case of Saudi Arabia, the old adage, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, meaning there's this strange relationship behind the scenes between Israel and Saudi Arabia. But recently, Saudi Arabia has basically come out and said, we're fed up with the Palestinians too. Prince Bandar has been criticizing the Palestinians to an unprecedented degree lately. And he says the Saudis are fed up with all the billions they've given the Palestinians. There's a political analyst in Saudi Arabia who said, I believe it was a couple days ago, quote, Palestinian leaders stole the aid sent to the Palestinian people. They built mansions in Washington and Paris and London while ignoring the suffering of their own people. There's another political analyst who's also Saudi who said, quote, we must be reminded that the hundreds of billions of money their leaders received to support their cause from Saudi Arabia throughout its history were capable of building the Palestinians' huge cities. Instead, Palestinian leaders used the money to buy private planes and luxurious buildings in Europe and the United States. Wow! Have things changed?
Oh, a watershed. Absolutely. Nothing less than a watershed. And first of all, we must remember Saudi Arabia is the leader of the Arab world and probably of the Islamic world by virtue of being the custodian of the two holiest places of Iran, which is on Saudi territory. You know, it's Mecca and Medina. This is the real holy places of Islam, not Jerusalem. Jerusalem is maybe number three. Also, if you add to the political power, money talks. Saudi Arabia is the richest Arab country, the richest Muslim country. So all other countries heed to what they say. And when Prince Bandar, which was the head of intelligence of Saudi Arabia, he was ambassador of Saudi Arabia to the United States. He knows a thing or two about the international community and about the region and about the Palestinians. Not only he said what you have accurately quoted about the Palestinians actually, to say politely, mismanage all their the donations.
I think the word in English is stole.
Stole. It's I would say embezzled. Yes, absolute corruption. but not just that. He said that he wrote. It's not just that he said. You know, it's on record that the Palestinian leadership. You know, he was quite careful to distinguish between the Palestinian people and their leadership. He said that the leadership betrayed their national interest in a consistent way. We're talking now for about 120 years. 120 years, there wasn't any people called the Palestinians. We were all Palestinians. It was just an administrative unit run by a mandate that was given to the United Kingdoms by the League of Nations. We won't go into that unless you really want to get some history facts here. But in any case, he said, Bandar, a very, very influential person, and you can bet your life, Barry, that if he said it, he would not have dared saying it without authorization and support.
Oh, yeah,
the Saudi government, of course.
So our listeners understand, in these countries, for all intents and purposes, there is no free press. If you say something reflective of what you believe policy should be, and it's not in line with the official propaganda ministry, the government, not only will your platform, quite honestly, be taken out from under you, so will your freedom. And it could be even worse than that. So,
right.
Let's be clear. The point you just made is reflective of a policy change of unbelievable proportion in Saudi Arabia, which is a harbinger of new policy changes to come out of the smaller, less powerful, less rich Sunni states in the Middle East. So,
yes.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, this is huge, huge news. Do you anticipate? Do you anticipate Saudi recognition of Israel in a treaty?
Yes. We'll go back again to your first question. You know, everybody in the Middle East, in the world actually, is looking up to November 3rd to see who will occupy the White House after next elections. And I would say that if Trump gets 4 more years, I see the Saudis on a heartbeat come out into the open and normalize relations with Israel and sign peace treaty according to what the Abrahamic Accords were. You know, if Prince Bandar not only is a supporter, I mean, like the entire government of this alliance with Israel out of their own interest of the Saudis against Sunni radical terror, whether it's ISIS or Al-Qaeda, against radical Shi'i terror of Iran. But he sees the Palestinians as the troublemakers in the region and for the entire Arab world. You know what he said in this article that you mentioned? He said that the Palestinian leadership was always on the wrong side of history. He said in 1991, where the entire Arab world was coming to the defense of Kuwait against Saddam Hussein, who invaded, occupied Kuwait, and was going after Saudi Arabia and all the Gulf waterways, the oil waterways. He said when Saddam was beating up on Arabs, the Palestinians went up to the roofs to dance and to throw candies. I mean, this is it, yes. And then he went back all the way to 1939, where the Mufti, Haj Amin al-Husseini, went to see the Hitler in Munich and supporting basically the Nazis. So here he drew a straight line, historical line, from 1939, the Nazis, to Saddam Hussein, where the Palestinians were on the wrong side of history. And I can also, you know, add to that that during the entire Cold War, Palestinians were with a tyrannic evil empire of the defunct Soviet Union. So there is a major shift here, which came out of necessity, basically, because of the threats to Saudis and to the older Sunni countries from Iran, from radical terror. And there is another thing here, Barry, which is maybe a little bit overlooked. You know that oil probably is going to grow out of its usefulness. Could be 15 years, could be 25 years. All the Arab countries, the Gulf countries, understand it, and they need to prepare for the future. They need to build an industrial base. Not only that, they need to meet the challenges of the future, which are very acute here in the desert climate of most of the Middle East, in terms of food security, in terms of water availability, in terms of affordable, clean energy. And for that, they also need Israeli high tech in food security, in water development, in many, many other things which can keep a sustainable development. And this is where, again, the Palestinians are on the wrong side of history. Instead of really collaborating and moving into this camp of peace that just got a major, major boost with the peace with the Bahrain and the Emirates, and of course the backing of Saudi Arabia, joining also the older peace agreements with the Jordan and Egypt. We need a Middle East which takes care of its people. And the Palestinians, again, side with the Iranians and the terrorists.
Let's talk about a rating of the United States leadership presently and possibly in 2 weeks. To begin with, how would you rate the U.S.-Israel relationship now under President Trump?
I would say on a scale of 0 to 10 or 1 to 10, I would say 9. 9 because, you know, 10 is only for God to achieve. but it is better than it has ever been. Better than it has ever been. And it's not just the support of Israel vis-a-vis Iran and the terrorists, Hezbollah or Hamas. It's also vis-a-vis the BDS. You know, when the United States has Israel's back and when the United States defends Israel in the United Nations against all kinds of ludicrous condemnations, that really goes a long way. And all the other BDSers are going back to their holes. When the United States, and I'm afraid to say that under Obama, when they looked at Israel as a fair game, political warfare, the situation was terrible in the United Nations. Let's talk about that.
Mm-hmm. I know you've spent time with President Obama. I know you spent time with Joe Biden. If it's a 9 now, meaning it would be a 10, but God is not at the table, so this is as good as it gets with men, what would be your number of what it was under Obama?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say under Obama it was probably 4. And why am I saying 4? Because the defense cooperation was very good. But why was it very good? Because it was also very important for the United States to enjoy the defense cooperation with Israel. And this defense cooperation goes both ways, in terms of Israeli technology, in cyber, in missile defense, in terror operation methods, counterterrorism methods and and tactical and operational experience that saved a lot of American lives. But when it came to the political arena, we were thrown under the bus. And this is why nothing was achieved. The Palestinians were actually pushing forward. They did not compromise at all because they believed that that Obama will bring Israel on a silver platter to them. So this actually hindered peace. And the pressure on Israel was tremendous. And when America pressures Israel, just think what the cue is for all other countries, starting with the Europeans pressuring Israel. You know, during the last almost 4 years of Trump, you didn't hear much condemnations from Europe against Israel because they all understand that the U.S. has Israel's back. So, and why is it so important? Because, again, when Obama said that there should be a daylight between Israel and the United States, it turned the entire Middle East upside down. The deterrence was lost. Terror was, increasing. And the worst thing that happened was that Iran got stronger and the Sunni governments were weaker, which meant that the entire Arab world was on the brink of collapse. When in 2011, there were demonstrators against the dictatorship of Mubarak, and Mubarak was an ally of the United States. And in the Middle East, unfortunately, the choice is not between Jeffersonian democracy or a military government. The choice is between stability and terror. Mubarak meant stability. President Obama and his administration, when the demonstrators came out to the squares in Cairo and throughout Egypt, he said, Mubarak has to go. But 2 years before that, May 2009, the Green Revolution, when millions of Iranians came out against the dictatorship of the Ayatollahs in Iran, and all these demonstrators, mostly students and the young generation, were actually begging for American support, even just a moral support. What was the word from Washington? This
violence.
Is a domestic, yeah. This yeah. is an internal issue of the Iranians. We do not
interfere. Yeah, they were slaughtered in the streets and we did nothing.
Yes, and no one word of condemnation against this dictatorial, murderous regime. So what was the following that, what was the result? Basically, that Iran was much more bolder in supporting Hezbollah, in terror over on European and Latin American land. If you recall, there were Iranian-backed terrorists who were doing whatever they wanted in Germany, in Brussels, murdering. Opponents of the regime and others. So I would say that the traditional, the long-standing allies of the United States in the region, they saw that they were thrown under the bus, and that the United States is switching alliance, preferring the Shiites of Iran over the Sunnis of Saudi Arabia and the Sunni countries.
All right, so and shine off your crystal ball. Look forward a few weeks. Let's say
the next president of the United States is a guy named Joe Biden, who you know personally. What will the future hold for Israel with a Joe Biden, Kamala Harris White House?
Well, of course, I don't have a crystal ball, but I can tell you that, you know, I have met Joe Biden, you know, many times. Very affable. I like him very much on a personal basis. He is a friend. He is a friend. I remember always he told me that he was the only senator alive who had met all prime ministers of Israel since Golda Meir until now, which is true. You know, he was first elected to the Senate in 1972. At that time, Golda Meir was still the prime minister, and he met everyone. If you look at his voting record in the Senate, it's impeccable. However, if he says now that he will go back to this very, very bad, dangerous Iran deal, that's again going to upset the entire Middle East. It's going to be a grave danger for Israel, for all the U.S. allies, and subsequently the United States itself. When President Obama lift off sanctions and send money, over $100 billion of money that unfrozen assets of the Ayatollahs. Not only that, they demanded for some reason, you can just imagine what for, $1.5 billion in cash, and that was given to him. That meant that the Ayatollahs are free to do whatever they want. Terror.
So what is Biden going to do? So what is Biden going to be? Good for Israel, bad for Israel?
I can only judge him by his words. If he's going to go back to the Iranian deal, that's going to be very bad. And again, I say not just for Israel. I mentioned for the entire Middle East. Not only that, the Palestinians, which are also waiting to see what will happen in Washington after the elections, they will go back. You know, if there's ever any chance for them to come up to any kind of a compromise, they will never want to do it. They will think, okay, we can sit back and relax. The Americans will pressure Israel.
Not good news, but I think you're right. So in a brief summary, tell our listeners what happened with the UAE peace deal that also included Bahrain.
Well, I think this is an amazing achievement. I think this is, again, has to be the kudos are for Trump and his administration by actually looking with a fresh, I would say, view over the Middle East and saying, you know, five successive American presidents try the same thing over and over again, just hitting a brick wall. And that was what was the paradigm of those American presidents, like the international community, is that first and foremost, we have to have peace between Israel and the Palestinians, and then the entire Arab world will come, and peace in the Middle East. That the crux, that the real problem of the Middle East is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And this is not the case. Come Trump and say, no, the problem is not the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The core problem is the deficiency of democracy, is the terror by Iran and ISIS, which are rampant and nobody's stopping them. No future for younger generations. And in order to help the Middle East, we have to have first and foremost normalization and peace between Israel and the Arab countries. not to keep the entire region hostage by the Palestinians, and it worked.
And so we have a peace treaty between Israel, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates that was pushed through under the sponsorship, urging, and support of President Trump. He was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize that he absolutely, in my opinion, should have gotten for what he did. I'm not surprised he didn't, knowing the Nobel Committee. That's the same group that gave the Peace Prize to Barack Obama before he ever did anything in the world, and it basically cheapened the prize to virtually meaningless. I wouldn't say the same about, say, medicine or physics or literature, but in terms of the Peace Prize, it's almost nonsensical at this point. What's going to happen between Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates and Israel now, and what is already happening in Israel where you are?
Well, first of all, there is a great enthusiasm, and already I can tell you, I received so many calls from the Emirates for collaboration, economic, cultural, any cooperation, tourism. They would love to come after COVID, of course. They invite us, I would say, as brothers to visit with them. The enthusiasm is shared, not just by Israelis, but by all the Gulf countries, which is just amazing. And I think once they see that an understanding that Israel is not the problem in the Middle East, Israel is the solution. And once they understood that, they embrace Israel, and the relationship is going to go very, very strong.
Yeah, I saw that, I think it was today, there's a cargo ship just arrived in Israel, the first one in Israeli history from Bahrain. Mm-hmm. There's flights going back and forth now. Airspaces are being opened up for Israeli flights to cross Saudi Arabia. And that's extraordinary. There's rumors about, oh my goodness, a good half a dozen countries following along behind these two, which I never thought I would see the day, and yet it's happening, you know. It's extraordinary times. Amongst Israelis, do they get how significant this is?
Oh, I think so. Absolutely. Absolutely. But, of course, in this age of political polarity, then I would say the left in Israel, they are giving Netanyahu the kudos, but very, very begrudgingly. But all Israelis understand that this is a major, major development, which tremendously helped Israel's position in the world and certainly in the Middle East.
Well, I've got to tell you, from an American perspective, it got covered here for a few days, and then everything became COVID and we hate Trump on all major media outlets here, with the exception of a few that tend to be conservative. So let's talk about Iran. You mentioned it earlier. I'm completely stunned that since President Trump pulled us out of the Iran nuclear deal, but the rest of the world still thought it was like the greatest thing ever, Iran has been breaching the agreement on a daily basis, supporting terror internally, supporting terror all over the Middle East, building missiles like crazy, enhancing uranium, adding centrifuges, threatening to have a bomb in 15 minutes, and bragging about their ability to destroy half the world. And yet, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris make no secret of the fact they can't wait to go back into the deal. What would it mean for Iran if the United States signs up again?
Well, it means that they will have much, much more funds to support and initiate terrorism all over the world. You know, Hezbollah's wings are clipped because Iran had to cut by half their aid to the Hezbollah from $1.2 billion a year to $600 million. This is this is a huge sum in itself, but just think doubling it. It will help Hamas, again, doubling it. It will help Venezuela, you know, Maduro. It will just help the militias, the Shiite militias in Iraq to fight against American troops. It will, of course, help the Shiite militias in Syria also to take over. It will have enough funds to improve their ballistic missiles so they can reach, not just cover the entire Middle East, but also can reach the eastern shores of the United States. They're talking about 10, they have on their drawing board 10, what we call ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles, that can reach 10,000 kilometers, let alone keep and have a state-of-the-art infrastructure for creating and detonating a nuclear device. They may not do it during the time of the agreement, which anyway, the time of the agreement has 5 more years. In 5 more years, they can just walk freely out of this agreement, and then they can run, break through to the bomb in a matter of months. And I'm afraid all these last 4 years of great achievements of putting Iran at bay and all the terror organizations that are being nourished by them, all these achievements will just go down the drain.
Wow. So, Danny, we have some questions coming in from listeners. I'm going to go to the first one, which is a terrific question. Islamic law allows for lying to and misleading non-Muslims, the doctrine of taqiyya. And Muhammad talks about you can make a treaty with the non-believers, and you're allowed to break the treaty because it's not really something you're bound by, because you might not be strong enough to conquer them, so you make a treaty, and then when you're strong, the line or taqiyya ends, and you know this doctrine of a hudna, which is a cessation of violence, is replaced then by war or an attack when you feel strong enough to conquer the non-believer. That is Islamic doctrine, and as we know, it's non-changeable, non-negotiable, and is in cement, so to speak. With that understanding, how is it that Israel can make a treaty with a devout nation where Islam is the religion of the country? It's the state religion of the country, and the country is run along traditional Islamic religious lines. How does Israel make a treaty with a country like that and expect and anticipate that the country will observe it in perpetuity?
Well, only through deterrence and only through a built-in mechanism in any treaty that will protect Israel and will keep its military edge over any Muslim country or a coalition of Muslim countries. You know, with Egypt, we have peace, but this is with a non-religious regime of Sadat, Mubarak, and now Sisi. Thank goodness that Morsi, the Islamic Brotherhood president, is not in power. Same thing is with King Hussein. With the Palestinians, you know that Arafat was, you know, on record in South Africa in 1994 when he bragged that the agreement with Israel is going to be just like the agreement between the Prophet Muhammad and the Quraysh tribe. The Quraysh tribe back in 630 AD was the only tribe that Muhammad could not conquer. So what did it, by the way, they were of Jewish origin. So what did he do? He signed a peace treaty with them. They were very happy. 2 years later, when they put down their arms, they were not worried about it. He just guerrilla way. He attacked them overnight, killed them all. And Arafat called he was going to sign with Israel, a Quraysh one. So, of course, we cannot trust them whatsoever. And this is why one of the major tenets of any agreement with the Palestinians is that they will be demilitarized. No way they can have an army.
Well, I get that with the Palestinians. And it's interesting that you mention the Quraysh tribe, because that was part of the question, which I didn't detail. But the questioner, I think, is curious not so much about the Palestinians, who literally sit on borders and roads that run in and out of all these territories. And, you know, you and I have both been all over that area, obviously you thousands of times versus me on my many trips to Israel. But the truth is that when you've got foreign countries, in this case, very, very, very wealthy countries, that while they don't have armies or air forces or missiles to threaten Israel, they can fund almost unlimited interference in Israel or terror. So are you saying that Israel, for all intents and purposes, recognizes the story of the Quraysh tribe and what happened to them? They were all slaughtered because they believed the treaty? So that Israel doesn't lay down arms and always remain strong? So you have one eye on them with a smile, and then the other eye is sort of watching your own army stay strong? Is that the concept?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Not just a military might, but also very strong intelligence. So you can follow, you know, money and financing if it goes to any terror organizations, and call it out. But basically create relationship that will be beneficial to those Arab countries. And some of those Arab countries, I would say, are Islamists by name only. If you look at the Emirates or at Bahrain or at Oman, yes, they are Islamic countries. And, you know, they have all the trappings of Islam. But most of the people are not fanatic. You see it as when they go abroad and they drink wine and they go to discotheques and they really like Western lives. It's not like the regime in Iran, the Ayatollahs, which are very, very fanatic. The people of Iran, they do not like them. They would have loved to have Western. They used to have Western style lives in the past under the Shah. But Iran is a dangerous one. Erdogan of Turkey is dangerous one because he is radical Islamist to the core. But this is not the case with the governments of Gulf countries. It's not the case with Jordan or Egypt.
Well, that's good to know. There's a second question that has come in that's similar to the first, but it has a little bit of different slant. The Quran says, this is a quote, "O you who have believed, do not take the Jews and the Christians as allies. They are, in fact, allies of one another." And this was another story that's the end of the quote, that you cannot trust the Jews, whom are called by the Quran the worst of creatures. Under that understanding, and there's dozens of these quotes. I mean, Jews and Christians are looked at somewhere, apes and pigs, and all those real colorful slogans. Mm-hmm. Israel's literally ignoring that and pretending that this doctrine doesn't exist is the question. Mm-hmm. How is that possible?
Well, let me add one more verse of in the Quran, it's even worse because it's calling for killing the infidels, Jews and Christians, when they would run away from the mighty Islamists and will hide behind the trees or behind the walls. The Islamists will ferret them out and just behead them and kill them. No, I know it's terrible. This is why we have to go back to the basics peace with power, with strength, peace from strength, and try to I would say isolate religion from politics, especially when it comes to international treaties.
If I was to argue, there's a peace treaty which is a warm peace, and there's a peace treaty that's a cold peace. I would say the peace treaty with Jordan is a cold peace. They're still harboring terrorists, hijackers, and murderers that ought to be extradited that aren't. Egypt is probably a little better. And maybe that's because those two countries have borders with Israel, and there have been a number of wars, and many, many Egyptians and Jordanians and Israelis have all died. Israel seems to want a warm peace, and those countries seem to be afraid of their own populations rising up. As we know, a sizable population in Jordan considers themselves Palestinian Arabs rather than Jordanian Arabs, right? And so it's a little bit different. And maybe the argument is that, well, Bahrain and UAE and possibly other countries that may follow behind have never had a war with Israel. They don't have cemeteries filled with war veterans that died fighting Israel. Is that maybe the difference?
Yes, to a large extent. But there is another thing from, when you look at Egypt and Jordan, there are very, very strong cells of Muslim Brotherhood. And Muslim Brotherhood, they are in, for instance, in Jordan, they have infiltrated and they command the unions, all the labor unions in the parliament. And this is why the king, the Abdullah and before him, King Hussein, had to be just, walking on eggshells to be very, very careful not to, you know, and they incite, and of course they were always against the peace treaty. So this is why Israel is giving them kind of a blank check when they, you know, when they condemn Israel publicly. But of course, under the radar, there is tremendous cooperation in counterterrorism, defense, and many other things. Same thing with Egypt. The Muslim Brotherhood are very strong in Egypt. They're not in Bahrain or in the Emirates, and that makes a big difference.
Well, let's end it with this. I've heard a number of U.S. political leaders, and most prominently your old friend Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, advocating for the two-state solution still. And to the point of imposing an American viewpoint on how peace should look for Israel on Israel, and ignoring, largely ignoring, I should say, what Donald Trump has accomplished in his first several years in office. Is there still a two-state solution out there where there's a Palestinian state, I assume, on what is, from the Israeli perspective, called Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, and Israel in some sort of modified borders? In your mind, does that still exist as some sort of solution?
Well, to look at it from, let's say, natural resources, demography, you know, the area, the space between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean is just too small for two states. So it's like, you know, from the start that it will explode at some point, whether it's demographically or economically. And if you're realistic, the two-state solution, you can say, already exists. You know, Gaza, 100% of Gaza is under Palestinian control. Well, the fact that Hamas took over, this is because of the infighting among the Palestinians between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority. But they already have, you know, I would say the trappings of a state, you know, in Gaza, we said, but also, as we mentioned the outset here, Barry, that 40% of the Judea and Samaria is under total control of the Palestinian Authority. And so this, I would say, is the solution. Later on, if you know, if relations become so peaceful like in Europe, then, you know, it can be a kind of a confederation, Jordan, the Palestinians, and Israel, but certainly not a you know, a Palestinian state which will occupy the entire Judea and Samaria. This is not going to happen. That's a real recipe for disaster.
I remember a few years ago, I interviewed you in your living room in Israel with your lovely wife, Anne, as your chief assistant, and my daughter was there. It was really wonderful.
Sure.
You talked then about the Ambassador Ayalon peace plan that you had come up with. And since then, Trump has pulled off these miracles. I consider miracles in both his relationship and policy with the United States and Israel, and his sponsorship of the Bahrain UAE peace deal, you know, the Abrahamic Accords. We've moved our embassy to Jerusalem. We've recognized the Golan Heights as Israeli territory. There's not a millimeter of space between Israel and the United States now. As you put it, we went from a 4 to a 9, which is as good as it gets. with all that that's happened, what does the Danny Aiello peace proposal look like now?
Well, I would say again that first of all, we have to understand that it has to be a true peace, not a piece of paper. And a true peace means a historic reconciliation and a belief in peaceful coexistence and mutual recognition. And if this is the case, then really the sky is the limit. And you know, at the end of the day, it's not so much about the territory as about the relationship. And if we see a Palestinian people which is led by peace loving individuals, then a confederation is certainly a possibility, and Israel, you know, keeps, of course, the security, and also for all the Palestinians, and the economic benefits and joint ventures that you know, can spring out will give the entire region a great hope for the future.
Well, on that note, let's leave it there, and we'll pick this up again after November 3rd to decide, oh my God, what do we do now? Or isn't this great? Now there's going to be another 10 countries making peace with Israel. And then we can follow up, obviously, with an understanding of how things look with Iran and the rest of the Middle East, starting with Saudi Arabia. So special thanks to you, Danny, for coming on today. I think our viewers really, really appreciate the insight of someone who's close to the leadership in Israel, who has served his country as an ambassador here in the United States in a number of different roles, and is still very prominent on the international scene. I watch you on television all the time, so it's great to have you here. So
thank you so much.
Sure. Go ahead.
It's always a pleasure, and anytime you call, I'll be there.
All right. We really appreciate you, and I want to remind all of our listeners to subscribe to our text message alert system if you haven't done so already. Please text the word TRUTH and send it to 88202, push send. It goes through. You'll get a confirmation in about 3 seconds that you've been subscribed. It's always free. You'll get all of our stuff for free on your cell phone. And like I said earlier, if you're out of the United States and listening in Europe or elsewhere, you can obviously go to our website, americantruthproject.org, sign up for there. We never charge for content. It's always free. So, that being said, for ATP Radio, thanks for joining us today.
You were listening to ATP Radio. Make sure to text the word TRUTH, TRUTH, to 88202 to be notified of our future radio shows.